nightmares that haunt us our whole lives. And it makes us feel like there's something wrong with us, you know, or there's a demon attached, or, you know, this kind of haunting. But really, you know, what I've understood is that the nightmare can be your friend if you're willing to engage with it and really kind of understand what it's trying to tell you. What is the ego fighting?
It's Shelf Life. In this episode, we test Tolstoy's famous maxim that unhappy families are unhappy in their own way, as my guest, the musician Orenda Fink, best known for the band Azure Ray, discusses her love of Jeanette Wall's masterpiece on family dysfunction, The Glass Castle, as well as Tracy Letts' play, August, Osage County. Find out how they have influenced Fink's own memoir of turbulent family life after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump says he expects an agreement to be announced soon on ending the U.S.-Iran war. But no details have been made public, and Iran has not stated where it stands on the proposal. NPR's Greg Myrie has more.
President Trump said Saturday on Truth Social that an agreement has been largely negotiated, but he acknowledged details were still being worked out. The president claimed the agreement would reopen the Strait of Hormuz, though he didn't provide specifics. Trump took to Truth Social again on Sunday to say that the deal under negotiation would keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. The proposed deal appears to leave many of these difficult questions for further negotiation. Iranian officials and media reports say the U.S. and Iran have been making progress, but add that differences remain on key issues. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
The capital of Ukraine was struck by an intense wave of Russian missile and drone attacks today. The attacks took place shortly after the Ukrainian Air Force warned that Russia would launch a hypersonic ballistic missile. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports at least two people were killed and 56 were injured in the strikes.
For hours, all we could hear in Kyiv was the sound of constant explosions and the low growl of attack drones flying overhead. Many blasts came from Ukrainian air defense trying to shoot down 90 missiles and 600 attack drones launched by Russia. Writing on social media, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia hit a city near Kyiv with a hypersonic Oreshnik ballistic missile, which can carry nuclear warheads. It's the third time Russia has used this missile during its full-scale war on Ukraine. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
A failed execution in Tennessee is prompting calls for a pause on lethal injections. Tony Gonzalez with member station WPLN has more in the story.
Federal public defenders are pushing for a moratorium on lethal injections in Tennessee to allow legal challenges to be heard. They also want to probe into the protocol and qualifications of those involved. Last week, witnesses described more than an hour of painful attempts as a doctor failed to access a vein for the lethal injection of Tony Carruthers. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee gave Carruthers a reprieve for the rest of the year. Lee halted executions in 2022. An investigation found the state failed to test its lethal drugs or follow its own rules. The protocol was rewritten, and the state has since executed three men. For NPR News, I'm Tony Gonzalez in Nashville.
A building under construction collapsed in the Philippines today. Rescuers are searching for 21 people believed trapped in the rubble. Officials say one person is confirmed dead, a tourist from Malaysia in a nearby building who was hit by debris. This is NPR News. The Secret Service shot and killed a man near the White House last night. Officials say he had pulled a weapon from his backpack when he was approaching a security checkpoint and started firing. A bystander was injured. The Secret Service says none of its officers were hurt. The gunman reportedly had been arrested last year for attempting to enter a White House checkpoint, and a judge had ordered him to stay away. President Trump was in the White House at the time, but was not affected. Auto racers and fans are gearing up for today's Indianapolis 500. Quinn Kleinfelder from member station WDET reports several drivers are chasing history.
Driver Alexander Rossi qualified in second place, then crashed a day later during practice. But he says surgery on his left hand and right ankle won't keep him away from the race.
I will have to be on crutches because it's a weight-bearing injury, but fortunately to drive a race car, you don't have to bear weight.
Detroit-based Team Penske wants to add to its record 20 wins at Indy a year after facing criticism over rules violations, and Catherine Legge attempts to become the first woman to drive both Indy's 500 miles and a 600-mile NASCAR race in the same day. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Non-professional drivers taking road trips this Memorial Day weekend are finding higher gasoline prices than last year. The motorist group AAA says the national average for a gallon of gas today is $4.51 for regular. It was $3.18 at this time last year. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. This is NPR.
You know, a lot of us have nightmares that haunt us our whole lives, and it makes us feel like there's something wrong with us, you know, or there's a demon attached, or, you know, this kind of haunting. But really, you know, what I've understood is that the nightmare can be your friend if you're willing to engage with it and really kind of understand what it's trying to tell you. What is the ego fighting?
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hickman. Hello. Shortly after the 2020 COVID lockdown began, the musician Orenda Fink, best known for her early aughties band Azure Ray, purveyors of a distinctive melancholic pop folk, ordered a book. That book was Understanding the Borderline Mother by Christine Ann Lawson, and it changed Fink's life. In her new memoir, The Witch's Daughter, she uses the book as a springboard for examining her complicated, emotionally bruising relationship with her mother. "Life with my mother was like being in a trap," she writes. "Once you entered, there was no escaping." There is no escape either for the children in the two books that Fink has chosen to talk about in this episode of Shelf Life: Jeanette Wall's acclaimed memoir, The Glass Castle, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning play, August, Osage County, by Tracy Letts, in which the disappearance of an alcoholic patriarch unlocks a family's secrets. Orenda Fink, welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you. It is an honor to be here to speak to you today.
Well, thank you. You're best known as one half of the band Azure Ray, which you formed in Athens, Georgia, in 2001 with Maria Taylor. Your songs have been featured all over the place in movies like The Devil Wears Prada. You'd collaborated with Moby and the band Bright Eyes and toured with both of them. But writing a memoir is very different to writing a song. A song can be deeply personal, but it's still, in a sense, removed from you. I wonder, with a memoir, which is an act of such raw self-exposure, how that process differed.
Well, the Witch's Daughter had so many different iterations and even purposes throughout the years. It was really started over 10 years ago when I started writing about my dog dying. And when that dog Wilson died, because I got him when I was in my early 20s, something kind of broke in me psychically. And that was really the first time I realized, hey, I need therapy, number one. And number two, you know, there's a lot of things that I haven't really dealt with psychically. So the first writing I did really in long form prose was about my dog dying. And then I had this wonderful mentor, Timothy Shaffert, in Omaha, Nebraska. And he read through some of my early writings, and I had one paragraph about my mother in about 40 pages. And he said, this book is not about your dog. This is about your mother. And I was like, no, no way. And so that is the first version of this. And it went through many, many versions. So all that to say, the difference between kind of where I arrived at with this memoir and writing a song or even writing a record really couldn't be more different. Songs come out of me very quickly. They feel almost spontaneous. Whereas in this was a laborious, painstaking 10-year process of really getting at what was underneath, you know, almost every major experience in my life that I had remembered.
The Witch's Daughter, the title, comes from a book by Christine Ann Lawson. It's actually a type, a personality type. Early on in the memoir, you quote from her book, Understanding the Borderline Mother, witches want power and control over others so that others do not abandon them. They feel no remorse for nightmarish acts. Children live in terror of witches' capricious moods. They are the collateral damage of a secret war they did not start, do not understand, and cannot control. I wonder if you can describe how that personality manifested in your mother's case.
So the interesting thing about the title of the book is that I had the title The Witch's Daughter about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, because my mother is also a witch. So when I read the Lawson book, it was literally like, is there a glitch in the matrix? Like, what's happening here? You know, how can this be possible? Like, and so for people who do practice magic and witchcraft and anything of that nature, this doesn't denounce that at all, because certainly there are many beautiful practices in the world that manipulate energy, right? But with my mother, her witchcraft was very centered around revenge, and just like her personality in some ways, and even the extreme type of borderline personality that Christine Ann Lawson talks about. It's a very defensive posture. You know, everyone's out to get me. And as a child, whether you realize you might be that person or not, you're going to suffer at the hands of that paranoia or defensiveness. And so when I read Christine Ann Lawson's subtypes, I really identified her as the witch, because my mother really relished in being the bad guy. Even when she was trying to present herself as the good guy, there was this also this identification with the villain. She loved the villain in every movie, and she almost personified that proudly within her persona in the household.
Wow. Were there any villains that come to mind, movie villains, that she said, that's me?
So she was particularly entranced by Bette Davis's character in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, to the point where she even dressed up like her sometimes and wow. had her picture mounted on a telephone. She really loved that character. And, you know, and these are things about my mother that I actually really appreciated when I was in relationship with her. She was eccentric and she was fun. And it, you know, she was very, you know, on the fringe there, outside of the normal, what you think a normal mother would be like or identify with. But, you know, of course, there was a dark side that came with that.
Mm. Well, that dovetails very nicely, I think, with the books you've chosen, because both of them feature complicated, problematic mothers at their center. The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls and August Osage County by Tracy Letts. I am assuming those choices were deliberate. Do the mothers in these books resonate for you at a cellular level?
Yes. And the interesting thing is that definitely with Osage County. So I watched the movie first before I knew it was a play, as I'm sure many people did. And I didn't actually even really know what it was about. It took me unawares. I just put it on because I love Meryl Streep. And I was literally stunned. I mean, about a quarter of the way through, I couldn't believe what I was watching. I identified with it so much that, I mean, my mouth was open by the end of the movie. And I called my little sister immediately. And this was years and years before I went no contact with my parents. I was just so taken by it. I said, there's no way that this could be written, you know, out of the ether.
Right.
He must have experienced a similar family structure to mine. And it was the first time I'd actually thought, wait a second, if his family dynamics are so similar to mine, is there a pattern here? Is this something here that I'm not seeing? Because I always felt like my family was so unique in its dysfunction. So it was probably around that time that I started therapy. And, you know, slowly over the next 10 years, I began to realize, yeah, this is a pattern. And you can kind of, you can see the research, especially when it comes to borderline mothers or narcissistic parents, that even the siblings kind of fall in line in certain personalities. So that these were like really profound realizations. And it really, I would say, started with Augustine Osage County. Mm-hmm. Now, with The Glass Castle, I read that many years before because a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, Andy LeMaster from the band Now It's Overhead, I was on tour with him. I was having terrible nightmares and I would get drunk and basically just tell him all these terrible stories from my childhood. And one night, I mean, bless his heart, he was like, you know, you should really write this down. You know, I think because he's like, please give me a break. And I was like, you know what? You're right. I'd never written any of it down. That was the first time I had started writing any of my memories down. It was Andy that later came to me probably about a year later and said, have you read this book called The Glass Castle? I think you should read it. So yeah, I do have a really strong connection with both of these works. I kind of see my mother as more of Rex Walls, the father in The Glass Castle, than the mother.
Your story starts in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, rather poetically in a house that's kept cool by placing frozen milk cartons in front of the floor fans. But where do you see your mother and Jeanette Walls' father kind of merging?
Well, my mother is very charismatic. My father is more of the meek one. My mother is an artist and a writer like Jeanette Walls' mother, but I feel like personality-wise, she was more of the Rex Walls character. She's the more of the wild character, the one where all the chaos is centered around.
Right.
She's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
She is capable of great humor, let's say. When you're writing a memoir, and I've heard Jeanette Walls talk about this too, you can't put everything in there. You know, there's no way. And she said something that I really relate to. She said, I could have picked another handful of stories to make my parents look better. I could have picked another handful of stories that would have made them look worse. And I really relate to that. So, you know, that said, there were some things about my mother that aren't in the book that I do appreciate, you know, that she did have a good sense of humor. As much as the family system was so toxic, there was like this sense that we were all in there together. You know, we were very much loyal to each other. And that's where it gets a lot of kind of complicated. And you can even go into like narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder with parents. It can feel like a cult.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that cult leader can be very, very loving and charismatic at times. But then there's this flip side, right? Like where, well, but I don't have any autonomy within this. And so I kind of see that with Rex Walls a little bit. And I wonder if maybe Jeanette Walls left some of the darker parts of her father out of the book.
When you were 5 years old, your mother is committed to a mental ward. And your father tells you that she is sad, but the doctors will make her better. Obviously, they don't make her better. But I'm wondering if that was the moment when you began to understand that your mother was not like other mothers.
No, actually, it was not. I think that still at five, you're not capable of understanding that yet. You're still trying to piece out what's going on here. You know, maybe you can get into that zone, but you're not quite there. Of like, one of these things is not like the other. And also, you know, when my mother was committed in Tuscaloosa, we lived in a very rural area. We lived on a farm. I didn't really have any friends. You know, I hadn't really started school yet. I think it really, for me, wasn't until I was probably really getting into about 10 or 11 years old until I actually, when I started spending the night at my friends' houses, that's when I started to realize that nobody else's mother had a party all night in the kitchen. You know, nobody else's mother drank and smoked till 2 in the morning, listening to honky tonk, blaring, you know, shaking the dishes. that just didn't happen anywhere else.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest for this episode, the musician Orenda Fink. She's just published her memoir, The Witch's Daughter. Orenda, your mother has a history of banishing people from her life over any casual slight or imagined slight, and then demanding very elaborate apologies if they are to stay in her good graces. But your father stays with her, and you come to see him as another personality type at one point, the fisherman. Explain the characteristics of the fisherman.
So the fisherman is a name that Christine Ann Lawson gives to the type of person that would marry the borderline witch. You can kind of think of the temperament fitting in like a puzzle piece. You know, the borderline witch is very controlling, and the fisherman really wants to be controlled. And the name of the fisherman comes from a Grimm's fairy tale, The Fisherman and His Wife, where this fisherman finds this magic flounder that gives him three wishes. And his wife insists on, you know, all these excessive, grandiose wishes until finally the flounder cuts them both off. And you know, and the fisherman just kind of lets his wife take over, and her greed or whatever causes him to lose everything. And I think it's, you know, not lost on me that my father has really lost a lot too because of my mother. He's lost really all three of his daughters at this point. And that is the power of the witch over the fisherman. When you really get into the dynamics, let's say, of narcissism, the machinations of that work on another person, what is love versus codependency? And that's a question for the ages, I guess. But my father, he loves my mother, and he is very codependent on my mother. And I do believe that he believes he cannot live without her.
You trained to be an actor at the Alabama School of Fine Arts. What made you decide to give that up?
I was not a good actor, first and foremost. So that's mainly the reason. I had amazing instructors, and they were very kind, but they weren't encouraging me to go into it. They were like, maybe set design is better for you. And so I was like, oh, okay. But it wasn't really that I wanted to be an actor. It was that I wanted to get out. I wanted to get out of the small town I was in. I wanted to get away from my family. And, you know, as you do as a teenager, if you don't have much guidance, you're really just kind of grasping for this dream, you know, that's going to pull you out of where you are. And so that was acting for me. But it wasn't that I felt like I was destined to be an actor. So it was an easy pivot to music where I started playing guitar, a gift that my mother had given me, actually, and met Maria Taylor from Majere at the Alabama School of Fine Arts. And, you know, even though I finished out my high school as a theater major, and she was a dance major, we both knew when we graduated that we wanted to be musicians.
Your parents remain resolutely uninterested and unimpressed by your musical career. You write that your success is not so much a source of pride, but a threat to your mother. Why was that, do you think?
Well, some parts of me wondered if it was that my mother didn't want me to be a braggart, that she didn't want my head to get too big, you know, or get too big for my britches, as they say in the South. But once I started really, I mean, you know, and throughout my life, I did understand that. But then it got to the point where, but now you're hurting me, you know, by kind of dismissing my accomplishments, refusing to come to my shows. And then it made sense because I remembered even when I was very young, she wouldn't come to my elementary school recitals and speeches and things like that. And again, it's like, I don't want to go on a campaign demonizing my mother, even though it's very easy to do.
Right.
But in hindsight, I'm kind of like, oh, her excuse for, well, this is to keep you in your place. It doesn't really add up, you know, that she also wouldn't have gone to my elementary school recitals, you know?
Right.
And that there was an element of it that almost seemed punishing and withholding to me. So when I started studying borderline personality disorder, one of the prime traits of the borderline is that they're really threatened by abandonment. When someone with extreme borderline, and there is a spectrum, is threatened by abandonment to such a huge degree, it will really manifest in some pretty unusual ways. And one of them is that the borderline truly is threatened by other people's happiness and success, because in a sense, it feels like a threat that they may be left. They may be left behind, or they're not good enough. And I do think that that was playing out with my mother.
Orenda, one of the things that you have in common with Jeanette Walls is that despite these very dysfunctional family backgrounds, you both seem remarkably functional, outwardly happy, successful people, poster children, really, for surviving scarifying experiences and even thriving. What do you put that down to?
A couple of things, really. I mean, you know, I study Jungian psychology. I'm a Jungian coach. And a lot of that's been illuminating to me to kind of get a sense of like what the self archetype is that you're born with. And I do think that even though, you know, our unconscious is the great equalizer between all people, some of us are born with a little bit more strength, let's say, in the ego to withhold some of these major things, because the ego is what keeps us sane in the face of this kind of childhood adversity, the strength of your ego, really. So for whatever reason, you know, I think that there's maybe something that I was born with that was able to weather the storm in a way that was different than, say, my older sister. So I don't really take credit for that, but I'm incredibly grateful and very curious all the time. That said, I feel like writing this book has even challenged it. I feel almost more unstable in this place at this moment, breaking away from my parents and writing this book. And I bet a lot of people who are in the position that I'm in, they may say the same thing. It's very destabilizing to get out of a toxic family system. And it's very destabilizing to talk about it as well. So I've really been thinking about that a lot lately and really focusing on my own mental health and trying to make sure that I stay really present and in the moment and checked in.
One stabilizing factor might be your husband, Todd. He's also a musician. You met in Omaha, Nebraska when you were rehearsing to go on a European tour with the band Bright Eyes. After a one-night stand, you decide he's not for you. But when you meet again, supporting his band this time, you end up dating. What changed?
You know, I think what changed is he was playing hard to get on the second tour.
Always a winning formula.
It's a classic. It always works. Yeah, I wasn't excited that I was having to go on tour with, you know, yeah, the one night stand that I didn't like. And then he was not excited either because he's like, oh, I don't want to tour with this girl who dumped me. And so he was really standoffish. And I, you know, was watching him perform every night. And I was like, this guy's actually, he's very sexy. He's very kind. You know, I was kind of seeing who he was, but also getting ignored by him. And the combo is just, it worked. So after that tour, I was like, you know what? I think I do like this guy. And we've been together for 20 years.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. And my guest in this episode is the musician Orenda Fink. We're talking about two of her favorite books, including August Osage County by Tracy Letts and The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. We'll be back after this.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org. It's one of our most precious human abilities.
Empathy at a deep level is the understanding that someone else's world is just as real as yours.
Psychologist Jamil Zaki says we can grow our capacity for kindness and goodwill. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Monday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with the author Arenda Fink, best known for her band Azure Ray. She's just written a memoir, The Witch's Daughter. We're talking about one of her favorite books, The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. Arenda, we've talked a little already about The Glass Castle. It was on the bestseller list for more than 6 years and has sold well over 6 million copies. It was also made into a movie starring Woody Harrelson, Naomi Watts, and Brie Larson. It opens in Southern Arizona in a trailer park with a girl who loves wearing pink and is making hot dogs. She's 3 years old and standing on a chair to reach the stove when her pink dress catches fire and she goes up in flames. It's a powerful opening scene, horrifying, actually. She ends up in hospital with major burns, needs skin grafts, and is frankly very lucky to be alive. Right from the first, we witness her parents' irresponsibility. But despite this and many scenes in the same vein, Jeanette Walls doesn't really judge her unconventional parents. She kind of lets us experience them as fully rounded people. Often we see them through a child's eyes, and that can make them seem exciting, certainly never predictable. They're always moving to avoid rent collectors. When young Jeanette asks her father, Rex, where they're going, he replies, wherever we end up. How did you relate to this book as you were reading it?
This book just blew my mind when I read it. I had never read anything like it. And I think that's why it had this insane success. And what really struck me, and also was a huge inspiration for when I wrote The Witch's Daughter, was that she wrote through the child's lens. Because we forget when we get older and we see our childhood through our adult lens, what it was like when we were children. And it was remarkably different.
Yeah.
We do see our parents as gods. They are everything. And so, yeah, I related to that. Really actually started bringing up a lot of memories for me as well. And how some of these memories that the family would joke about, but it's like, oh, actually, you know, this isn't like the best heartwarming story. Maybe this wasn't so good, but yeah, I guess I've read Glass Castle at least 7 times.
Oh, wow. You're a groupie. Is there, having read it 7 times, is there a scene that stands out for you? One that you particularly relish, if relish is the right word, reading each time?
I mean, there's so many, but I really was revisiting it when I was writing kind of the final edits of The Witch's Daughter. And I was really struck. I talk again about The Matrix. When I read about them driving through Joshua Tree, stopping through Joshua Tree, which is where I ended up. And so to reread them in Joshua Tree makes me a little emotional. You know, that little Jeanette wanted to take the little sapling and put it in a protective place to keep it safe and away from all the things out here in the desert, you know, the harsh conditions. And her mother said, it's the Joshua Tree's struggle that gives it its beauty. It's just such a beautiful memory of Jeanette's and so poetic and kind of ties into the idea of not everybody is crushed under the weight of these types of childhood. Sometimes some beauty can come out of it, you know. And I think in a way, when I read The Glass Castle, even though there was no way I could have known that, you know, I would be writing a book about my family that many years later, I had hoped that my story would end like hers, you know, that she would write this book and, you know, make all this money and take her mother in and have this nice ending kind of wrapped in this bow, the way it's kind of seems to me from the outside. So it's a little unfortunate to me that mine didn't quite end that way, but it was something that I kind of aspired to.
I have to ask, do you miss talking to your mother at all on any level?
Yes, I do. My sister and I both do, and it's very difficult. You know, we talk about it all the time. We cry about it. Like I said, you know, it's very destabilizing to get out. You know, I'm not sure when that will ever change. These are part of the decisions you have to make when you decide to go no contact with a toxic family system. And it's also kind of the themes of, I mean, I guess it's the theme of my book to a degree. It's the theme of Glass Castle and August Osage County. Where is the line between responsibility or obligation to your family and obligation to yourself? And when the obligation to your family starts ruining your life or infringing upon your well-being, you know, can you step away? These are the big questions.
Yeah. You mentioned there that scene with the Joshua tree in the Mojave Desert, where Jeanette Wall's mother, Rosemary, is so taken by this tree that Jeanette initially thinks of as quite ugly, that they end up living in a small trailer park there. It's an example of the kind of romanticism of the parents, in a way, to see beauty in things that other people may not find beauty in. And that parallels for me another scene in which her father, Rex, takes them out into the desert one evening. It's Christmas Eve or shortly before Christmas, and he gifts them each a star as their Christmas present. Let's hear it.
Dad lost his job at the gypsum mine after getting into an argument with a foreman. And when Christmas came that year, we had no money at all. On Christmas Eve, Dad took each of his kids out into the desert night one by one. I had a blanket wrapped around me, and when it was my turn, I offered to share it with Dad, but he said no thanks. The cold never bothered him. I was 5 that year, and I sat next to Dad, and we looked up at the sky. Dad loved to talk about the stars. He explained to us how they rotated through the night as the earth turned. He taught us to identify the constellations and how to navigate by the North Star. Those shining stars, he liked to point out, were one of the special treats for people like us who lived in the wilderness. Rich city folks, he'd say, lived in fancy apartments, but their air was so polluted they couldn't even see the stars. We'd have to be out of our minds to want to trade places with any of them. Pick out your favorite star, Dad said that night. He told me I could have it for keeps. He said it was my Christmas present. You can't give me a star, I said. No one owns the stars. That's right, Dad said. No one else owns them. You just have to claim it before anyone else does. Like that Dago fellow, Columbus, claimed America for Queen Isabella. Claiming a star as your own has every bit as much logic to it. I thought about it and realized Dad was right. He was always figuring out things like that. I could have any star I wanted, Dad said, except Beetlejuice and Rigel, because Lori and Brian had already laid claim to them. I looked up at the stars and tried to figure out which was the best one. You could see hundreds, maybe thousands or even millions, twinkling in the clear desert sky. The longer you looked, and the more your eyes adjusted to the dark, the more stars you'd see, layer after layer of them gradually becoming visible. There was one in particular, in the west, above the mountains, but low in the sky, that shone more brightly than all the rest. I want that one, I said. Dad grinned. That's Venus, he said. Venus was only a planet, he went on, and pretty dinky compared to real stars. She looked bigger and brighter because she was much closer than the stars. Poor old Venus didn't even make her own light, Dad said. She shone only from reflected light. He explained to me that planets glowed because reflected light was constant, and stars twinkled because their light pulsed. I like it anyway, I said. I had admired Venus even before that Christmas. You could see it early in the evening, glowing on the western horizon. And if you got up early, You could still see it in the morning, after all the stars had disappeared. "What the hell," Dad said. "It's Christmas. You can have a planet if you want." And he gave me Venus.
And that was a short excerpt from the audiobook of The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls, read by the author herself. You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, the musician Orenda Fink, who's just written her memoir, The Witch's Daughter. Orenda, there's something so optimistic and so childlike about Rex that I found it hard to judge him even at his worst after reading that. He's highly irresponsible, and yet he and Rosemary have moments of extraordinary grace, I would say. How did you synthesize those two sides to him?
You know, he is such a complicated character, and I think she did such a beautiful job with him. And again, I guess I'd refer back to what I said before, which is that, you know, this is her picture that she is painting of him. I'm sure that he's even more complex than we understand. But to me, the stories that stood out where I saw him as more of the bad guy was when she was in the bar and ended up kind of almost being assaulted by the boy upstairs. He was basically kind of selling her. And I thought, wow, you know, that's even worse than kind of driving a car recklessly. This is kind of calculated. So there's this real darkness to Rex Walls. And who knows, but Rex Walls might have had a little borderline in him himself. And with men, with many borderlines, alcoholism is very common, just as a use of self-medication. But there's this kind of emotional violence for women, and men, it can translate into a physical violence. Usually women are not physically violent as borderlines, but men are. And that's why you kind of tend to think of borderline as more of a feminine diagnosis, but it's really just because most men aren't diagnosed because they end up in prison. But, you know, at the end, it's like, it's hard, you know, with my mother. I mean, it's why I stayed in relationship with her so long, because when the person is doing all this stuff out of desperation of trying not to lose you, there is this sense of like, well, they really love me. You know, that's why they're doing all this stuff. And so there's a way that you can look at it like that for sure. But then when you realize that if I don't be exactly who they want me to or need me to, then they don't love me. Was that ever love?
You compared Rex in The Glass Castle there to your mother's father, your grandfather. In The Witch's Daughter, there's a powerful, painful scene where your younger sister and you, in conversation with your mother, are confronted with her own history as a child. She says she was abused by her father. Do you think that her victimhood explains her behavior?
Yes and no. It explains it in the sense that that which she went through with her father and mother combined with the genetic predisposition gave her what I believe to be is a very, very extreme case of borderline personality disorder. So yes, that it does excuse that. But, you know, you mentioned that the story of when she confesses to me and my sister that she was sexually abused by her father. Well, her brother, you know, denies that. I think her mother denied that too, and so did her other sister. So it's really just my mother telling the story. And honestly, I believe my uncle, because my mother lied about so many things, it does not add up that that story is true. And also, you know, that confession came out when we were really nailing her to the wall about her bad behavior. It was almost like in the spirit of, oh, you think your childhood was bad? Well, here's what happened to me. It's like, oh, this is the first time I've heard this. Huh. You know, and it's almost unthinkable that someone would lie about that, but it does happen. And so again, it's complicated. Like, how do I know what actually happened to my mother? I don't.
Rex has his own backstory. There's a section in The Glass Castle where they go to live with his mother. And it's probably the grimmest section of all. And she's a monster herself. She keeps the children in the basement. She molests Jeanette's brother or starts molesting him one day. And there's a suggestion that she abused Rex when he was a child. I found that the sort of hardest section in the book.
Yeah, it's so sad. Again, it's like, oh, why was Rex this alcoholic? Because he endured a horror from his own mother. And I think that, you know, everyone in my family suffers from mental illness. Everybody, including myself. You know, I have anxiety and depression and mainly those two things. Otherwise, I'm perfect. But those can really take a hold, you know. It takes, like I said, it takes a very strong ego to make it out of this unscathed. I mean, and I would say it's impossible to even come out completely unscathed. But if your ego is weak, or, you know, your psyche just can't handle it, yeah, you end up becoming a very dysfunctional person, maybe even schizophrenic. You know, your ego might completely dissolve altogether because it's just too painful to look at the reality of what you've been born into and what you've experienced.
Orenda, can we talk a little about your fascination with magic? So despite being the daughter of a witch, you go on a journey to Haiti at one point to study voodoo, including attending an animal sacrifice. To a layperson like me, that sounds pretty scary. What did you get from it? What did you learn?
I mean, I learned a lot about the culture and the religion in general. So there was, I had such a wonderful guide there, Jean-Luc de Sable. And I just felt like I was learning a new world, a different way of living that was so different from what I had grown up with. And, you know, of course, it tied into magic too, because I had this history of being exposed and talked to about magic in all kinds of degrees. And it just kind of sunk into my bones of wanting to understand it on an intellectual level. But yeah, so, you know, and there were times that I was scared. We were in a town called Léogán, deep in the heart of the countryside, and in some pretty frenetic ceremonies with the sacrifices. And yeah, I talk about a story in the book where the generator goes out and we're just in complete and utter darkness alone. But, you know, Jaloki, when we finally found him, you know, he just said the most amazing thing. He's like, you're in the most sacred space in Haiti at this moment. You're in the safest place in the entire country. This is the only place in Haiti I can say you will not be hurt.
It leads to a brief breakthrough with your mother. You call her from Miami Airport and say to her, you know, look, I understand you. She sort of has a moment of kind of choking up and acknowledging you in what is an all too rare occasion. How did that feel?
It felt really beautiful at the time. You know, it felt overwhelming. It felt like, okay, let's say if I was writing the story of my life, that could have been the perfect ending. But I think that, you know, even though it was a beautiful moment that I shared with my mother, much like everything kind of in our relationship, you know, she was always going to draw. And at some point, it kind of made it hard to even have those good moments anymore. Because at that time, I still believed there could be a happy ending to this. And it was almost like it was my life's mission to make sure that happened.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Orenda Fink, better known as one half of the band Azure Ray, as well as her own solo work. She's the author of The Witch's Daughter. We're talking about one of her favorite books, August, Osage County, by Tracy Letts. Orenda, when August, Osage County, by Tracy Letts opened on Broadway in 2007, it was kind of immediately recognized as a great American play, something that happens all too rarely. I remember seeing it myself and being mesmerized by the interplay between the various members of the Weston family. The play takes place over a few weeks in August inside the three-story home of Beverly and Violet Weston outside Pawhuska, Oklahoma, an actual real place. The play's great achievement is to introduce a patriarch, Beverly Weston, in a brief prologue and then kill him off, basically. Although we don't see that or know that immediately. We only learn about it in the course of a family gathering brought about by his disappearance. And during that gathering, everything unravels. Family secrets are exposed to the daylight. Talk about dysfunctional families. How did you first experience August Osage County? I think you said you watched it as a film initially, with that great performance, of course, by Meryl Streep.
Yes. So I did see it first as the movie, and about a quarter of the way through, my mouth just started hanging open. I was like, this is my mother. Barbara is me. Ivy is my little sister. Karen is my older sister. You know, not completely, but pretty dang close, you know, as far as two family dynamics can go. And of course, Beverly is in some ways my father, who has been kind of this removed, suicidal man that can't leave this just monster of a woman. And I just, I was so taken by it. And I did relate to Barbara in a huge way. I was like, oh, maybe I should be nicer to my husband.
I'm sure he'd be very happy to hear that. You said it. Violet Weston is a monster. There's really nothing redeeming about her. And yet the play works. She's, you know, I mean, she's obviously multidimensional, but primarily the note you get is this is a woman who is very destructive. What makes that work so well, do you think?
Well, the funny thing is that I don't know if it's just because I grew up with a similar mother figure. I did see a little bit of humanity in Violet. you know, I was catching it where he was throwing it in. You know, she is this very pitiable character in some way. She's got cancer of the mouth. She has a husband who is an alcoholic who, you know, you can see is deeply disconnected to her, but that's, you know, obviously of her own making. But you find out he's had an affair with her sister and had a child with her. You know, she's abused in childhood, right, as well, emotionally abused by her own mother. I mean, the story about the boots, that literally could be coming out of my own mother's mouth.
Tell us the story.
Violet Weston is telling a story to her daughters about when she was a child. She had a crush, I think, on a little neighbor boy who had these beautiful chocolate cowboy boots. And she thought that if she got some boots just like his, if I'm remembering it correctly, he would love her, you know, that he would want to be her boyfriend. So she begged her mother for these cowboy boots for Christmas and said she would give it all up if she could just have these boots. And at Christmas, she had this boot-shaped package with this beautiful wrapping under the tree. And when she went to unwrap what she thought were the boots, there were a pair of men's used work boots, like falling apart and caked in mud, basically. And her mother just laughed and laughed and laughed. And at some point, Barbara, her daughter, goes, please tell me that's not the end of the story.
As you say, it could be a scene taken from your own book, The Witch's Daughter. Yeah. Did you see other parts of your story in August Osage County? What else resonated for you?
One thing that really resonated with me was Barbara's strong desire to save her mother from, at least even from the pill addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the play, she leaves her, she walks away. And I see that as a final leave. I thought there was a lot of weight to that ending of her saying goodbye. So days before literally walking away from this person forever, she's trying to save her. And she's willing to wrestle her to the ground, knock over chairs to take these pills out of her hand. And I related to that so much because it does become a mania to save the dysfunctional people in your family when your well-being, when you think your well-being is somehow predicated upon it, you know. And I just really relate to that. And that breaking moment of, okay, I'm throwing up my hands, I can't do this anymore. Mm. When I got to the end of the movie for the first time, I was shocked. It's so not a Hollywood ending. And I think, like, even though I would never have imagined that it was going to end the same way for me, I do remember kind of having the thought of, oh, you can do that?
Did you relate to the geography of this play? It's set in this tiny town. Was that something you were able to identify with because it was in a part of the world that you were familiar with?
more than that, even I identified with the idea of getting out. You know, there's this conversation that Ivy, the younger sister, has with Karen and Barbara, full of kind of bitter resentment that they just left her there with their mother, and that they got out and now it was her turn. Even though that doesn't exactly mirror my experience with my other sisters, there was always this sense for me of getting out and then having gotten out, going back home, and what all that means, because it's much more than a geographical thing. And I thought it was really interesting the way that Tracy Letts wrote the last week, I think, or last couple of days that Barbara was staying alone with their mother after everyone had left, that she had stopped dressing. She was wearing pajamas and not fixing her hair anymore, or maybe not bathing. I can't remember. But that, yeah, you could just kind of even tell that Barbara kind of had started losing her spirit being there with her mother, resigning back to that childhood place. It's interesting because in the work that I do, the Jungian work, you know, with dreams, the setting of the dream tells you a lot about where your mental space is. And a lot of us dream about our childhood homes. And depending on what the nature of the dream is and what's going on in your life, it can tell you a lot about where your state of mind is, you know.
Do you still dream of your childhood home?
Yes, I just did last week, actually.
And what happens in those dreams?
A lot of times I will have moved back in with my parents and I will be wondering why I live there and if I should move out. In this dream last week, I was with my friend Morgan, who I mentioned in the book, and she and I drove up to the castle at night as adults, and we got out of the car and she was like, "What are we doing here?" And I said, "Don't worry, we're just going to go inside and take photographs and maybe spend the night."
And Orenda, now that you've written your first book, a memoir, do you see more books in your future, or are you going to return to writing music?
I definitely see more books in my future, in my crystal ball. I love writing and I loved music too, but I feel like I have crossed over into the writing world. And so I'm just going to maybe linger here for a while. But yeah, I'm very excited to start working on a new project.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to reading whatever you have in store for us next.
Thank you so much. It's truly an honor. And what an amazing conversation. And I just love the format of this and being able to talk about the other books. It's just been such a pleasure.
And we're gonna play you out with some of your own music. So here is my guest, Orenda Fink, singing "Why Is the Night Sad?", one of her songs. We've been talking about The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls, published by Scribner, and August Osage County by Tracy Letts, published by Theatre Communications Group. Orenda Fink's memoir, The Witch's Daughter, is published by Gallery Books. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and 1 Gram Books in association with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, Jonathan Escoffrey, and Joanna Quinn. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating? It will help others find the show.
Why is the night sad? I know it doesn't help to ask, why is the night so sad?
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
You've heard of mom brain, but how do men's brains change when they become fathers?
I was an emotional person before, but now I feel like I'm always crying at the most little things.
Becoming more aware of noises and sounds.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, the new science of dad brain. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
With Morning Edition from NPR News, you don't have to wonder where your information is coming from because we tell you. Get your news straight from the source every weekday.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.